Today's WBFO brief was recorded at around 8:30 in the morning. This is WBFO News.
Today is a day set aside to reflect on the legacy of Native residential and boarding schools, their survivors, and those who never came home. In Canada, it's a statutory holiday, Truth and Reconciliation Day. In New York and elsewhere in the United States, it's observed as Orange Shirt or Every Child Matters Day. WBFO's Ryan Zunner has more.
Kill the Indian, save the man was the mission of Native residential and boarding schools on both sides of the border. That's right from the mouth of Henry Pratt, founder of one of the most notorious schools located in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Schools where Native children were taken from their communities, often without consent of parents, had their hair cut, clothes taken, language and culture suppressed, and experienced high levels of abuse and disease.
The boarding schools were the ultimate in ethnic cleansing. And many of my colleagues have told me, you know, Dean, why don't you just call these schools what they are? You know, because a school has a playground outside, right? These boarding schools had graveyards.
That's Dean Seneca, a Seneca Nation member and longtime public health professional, formerly with the Center for Disease Control, UB instructor, and founder of Seneca Scientific Solutions. He links a bulk of health disparities facing Native people today to years of trauma from assimilation tactics.
This is a direct result of the health conditions that we have today, right? Diabetes, cardiovascular disease, unintentional injuries, substance use disorders, domestic violence, sexual violence. All of these things are plaguing our people because of this convoluted history and what has been done structurally to Native people.
A history the Canadian government has formally admitted and apologized for. It operated or funded over 100 schools, including the Mohawk Residential School in Brantford, Ontario, nicknamed the Mushhole by students for its poor quality food. Canada funded these schools until 1997. New York State operated the Thomas Indian School in Cattaraugus till the 1950s and has never taken responsibility. The U.S. government has also yet to make a direct apology for its hundreds of boarding schools, even after Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland, the first Native American woman in a cabinet position, oversaw a three-year investigation.
You know what? Native people cannot move forward and heal until there is some sort of reconciliation, until there's some sort of acknowledgement. The other thing, though, that I think is more important is that we know there's unmarked graves in our communities around these boarding schools. We've all heard stories about kids that would come there and the next thing you know, they're not there anymore. I think we really want to know how many of these unmarked graves are there.
A Canadian government commission estimated residential school deaths at over 6,000, and official numbers continue to rise with more research. Haaland's investigation reported nearly 1,000 deaths, but believes the numbers could be higher. On this Orange Shirt Day, Ryan Zunner, WBFO News.
A programming note from WBFO, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and Ohio Senator J.D. Vance will meet in New York tomorrow for the first and only vice presidential debate for the election season. Join us for live special coverage and analysis of the CBS News vice presidential debate simulcast from NPR News. That's tomorrow at 9. Buffalo residents will be paying more for water starting tomorrow. The announcement from the Buffalo Water Board arrived late Friday, with officials saying the rate hike was needed to assist in making capital improvements in the city water system. According to a release, the quote-unquote typical residential household will pay $32 more per year, while low-income households will pay another $12 per year. The Water Board's plans for $72 million in capital improvements include replacing lead service lines. Over 4,200 customers take advantage of Buffalo Water's 65 and over senior discount rate program, while more than 8,800 customers benefit from other affordability programs. Jeremy Zellner will continue to lead the Erie County Democratic Committee. By unanimous vote on Saturday, Zellner was elected party chair for his seventh two-year term, which is the second longest term for a party leader, trailing only Joe Krangel. The party also opted to increase its number of vice chairs from 7 to 9. Erie County Legislature Chair April Baskin, Fillmore Common Council Member Mitch Nowakowski, and Town of Tonawanda Democratic Chair John Krangel Jr. are among those vice chairs. And gasoline prices are continuing to drop. According to the AAA of Western and Central New York, the average price in Buffalo for a gallon of unleaded gasoline is $3.00. $3.38. That's down 3 cents from last week. The national average is $3.22 per gallon, 1 cent less than last week, and 60 cents lower than 1 year ago.
This WBFO Brief podcast is made possible by Canisius University, where high-flying grifts find a top-flight education. For the last 8 years, Canisius has been recognized on U.S. News' list of best colleges and universities. Learn more at canisius.edu.
Ontario Premier Doug Ford has a new plan to tackle traffic congestion around Toronto, Canada's largest city. Ford wants to build a tunnel under the country's busiest highway, the 401, from Brampton, west of Toronto, to Scarborough in the city's east end. Correspondent Dan Karpinchuk reports.
A report earlier this year found that Toronto has the most traffic congestion of any major city in North America. That includes New York and Mexico City. Premier Doug Ford made his pitch within sight of the 401 highway.
We need to keep building. That's why today I'm announcing that our government is exploring the feasibility of a tunnel under the Highway 401. This tunnel would serve as a new expressway for both cars and transit. This tunnel and expressway will cut gridlock, support economic growth, and help get people moving faster.
Ford says gridlock costs the Ontario economy an extra $11 billion a year through lost productivity.
If we don't act now to add extra highway capacity beyond what we're already building and planning, the number of hours lost to traffic will more than triple by 2051. And we can't just sit by and let this happen.
Ford wouldn't speculate as to the costs of the project, leaving that to the feasibility study, as well as a timeline. But opposition parties were quick to weigh in. Here's Merritt Stiles, the leader of the official opposition New Democratic Party.
This is not a serious proposal. This is not a serious premier. It is a silly thought from a government that has run out of ideas.
And the leader of the Liberal Party, Bonnie Crombie, was also quick to dismiss the premier's notion.
I really think that this is a pipe dream of an idea, and that the better solution would be to leverage existing assets.
Other lawmakers say the tens of billions of dollars that would be spent would be put to better use in building affordable housing. But Ford appears adamant that the plan will go ahead.
The feasibility study will come in, and we'll be transparent. But I'll tell you one thing, we're getting this tunnel built.
Experts are also skeptical about the plan. Maddie Semiatiki is the director of the Infrastructure Institute at the University of Toronto.
Building under an existing highway and keeping it operational is a technical challenge. It doesn't mean it can't be done. It can, but everything costs money. And in this case, the cost is going to be astronomical. The risks of delays are significant. And the fact that it won't solve the problem is really what we should be focusing on. We will be billions of dollars further in debt, and we'll still have the same gridlock problems we have in the region.
The proposed tunnel, about 35 miles long, would be among the longest in the world. There is support for the idea from the Toronto Region Board of Trade, which calls it bold and visionary. And the tens of thousands of drivers who use the 401 every day might also look on it favorably, especially since Ford says there will be no tolls for the tunnel. For WBFO News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto on the Canadian Beat.
For decades, the crash of the wrecking ball and the war of excavators were not uncommon sounds in Buffalo, as thousands of vacant properties were demolished due to economic decline. Now, there's a housing shortage in the city where most residents are renters, and almost half of those people are quote-unquote rent-burdened, meaning they spend a third or more of their paycheck on rent. WBFO's Holly Kirkpatrick takes a closer look at how a state pilot program looks to solve the problem.
Ayat Nieves takes me on a tour of a Buffalo property he's in the middle of rehabbing.
This is the unfinished kitchen right here, but right now we don't have the funds for the cabinets, the countertop, or the replacement windows.
Nieves is a real estate agent and local landlord. He owns less than 10 properties, all of which are in the city. Before he bought this one, it was vacant and abandoned, and when complete, it will be a two-unit rental property.
What state would you describe it as right now?
Unfinished and uninhabitable.
Nieves has spent the best part of his summer working on the property with his father, Khalil. He's working on the outside of the house, perched up high on a lift. Khalil is a hardworking, if sometimes reluctant, participant in his son's endeavours.
Are you enjoying your time up there?
Nope.
That was resounding.
Rehabbing houses is a way for Nieves to secure a stable financial future.
It's generational wealth. It's something for me to leave to my wife and children when I eventually pass.
But fixing up houses eats up a budget and fast. Nieves estimates the entire project will cost around $120,000. So far, he's fitted up the property with a new roof and new plumbing, complete with a new water line. But his funds have dried up. That means these units will sit empty for a while longer in a city that needs more housing.
For nearly 30 years, the really only consistent housing policy in the city of Buffalo was to demolish anything that they could.
State Senator Sean Ryan says there are approximately 4,000 rental units in Buffalo that are vacant because they're in need of repair, an approximation WBFO has independently verified.
At that time, everyone thought Buffalo was going to substantially shrink. But what happened was we had big demolitions over a generation combined with just a modest population growth of 10,000. And now we don't have enough apartments. So we knocked down all our extra units. So we got to get these 4,000 units back online.
Ryan has secured $90 million in this year's state budget for pilot programs to address housing needs in upstate cities, including Buffalo. $40 million of that cash will head out of the door in the form of grants for small-scale landlords to fund repairs that get units up to code.
And if you take the money, you just have to rent back into the community at the neighborhood rent. It's for 10 years.
The funding will be administered by local nonprofits who successfully apply to New York State Homes and Community Renewal. Stephanie Simeon is the executive director of Heart of the City Neighborhoods, a Buffalo nonprofit well-placed to apply to hand out the grants. But
we're not applying.
She says that although there's a need for more affordable rental units, it's that 10-year agreement to rent them at an affordable rate that's the sticking point, raising questions over how to ensure compliance.
That's a long time. You're going to get a lot of pushback. 10 years of maintenance to check in every year on all of those units. Who's paying for the paper, the printing, the follow-up? Because a lot of times when people get that injection, they're very responsive in the first 6 months because they're getting this product, you're doing the construction, everybody's great. A year later, you can't get the compliance back.
She adds that there needs to be some sort of education for those who have owned a vacant unit for decades and will become a landlord for the first time in years or ever, thanks to the state dollars.
What are we going to do to make sure that the landlord just says, you know what, I tried it, it didn't work out, I'm just going back to the same old thing. And now we no longer have those amount of units available for affordable housing.
These questions are surmountable for Executive Director of Broadway Fillmore Neighborhood Housing Services, Stephen Carnath. He plans to submit an application to administer the money and hopes to collaborate with Simeon's organization to source suitable local landlords to receive it.
Because it's a new program, you got to sort of make sure that you have agencies that can actually implement it and deal with all the various issues that go into successful implementation of a program like this.
Heather Abraham is a clinical professor at University at Buffalo's School of Law and a practicing attorney with a background in housing. Her research shows there's an upward trend in vacant rental units in need of repair in Buffalo, so she says Ryan's pilot program is well worth trying.
What remains to be seen is how the program will keep units affordable as they're added to the market. My question is there a plan to monitor the rents and to keep them low? And I will be watching for those details as they emerge.
And though the details are still being ironed out, that 10-year compliance period doesn't deter Nieves.
I like free money, and I will go above and beyond to get it. And I look at it like this. If they give you, let's say, $100,000 up front, that's money that you don't have to come up with, that's money you don't have to borrow, and that's potentially a summer that you don't have to give up doing a lot of the work yourself, like I did.
And with that, he steps back into the house to get back to work. Holly Kirkpatrick, WBFO News.
The Bills got throttled on Sunday Night Football. CSP reigned supreme on Friday Night Lights. And it's postseason time in the WNBA and MLB. I'm Jack Cruiser. This is The Scoreboard for Monday, September 30th. For fans that stayed up to watch the Bills play on Sunday Night Football, there was really only one positive outcome. They were able to head to bed a lot sooner than the end of the game, as Buffalo never took a lead. The Bills dropped to 3-1 on the season, suffering a 35-10 loss to the Baltimore Ravens last night. Everything looked easy for the Ravens in the first half, starting with their first offensive play of the game. Baltimore's Derrick Henry blew past the Buffalo defense for an 87-yard touchdown run. As injuries on the Bills piled up, the execution deteriorated for the Bills as the half went
on. The Ravens scored touchdowns on each of their first three drives, forcing the Bills to punt on four of their five first-half possessions. Baltimore had all of the momentum at the break, heading into halftime with a 21-3 lead. Despite the score, Buffalo came out firing in the second half, forcing a three-and-out on the Ravens' first drive, then Josh Allen doing Josh Allen things. While being pushed out of bounds on third down, the gunslinger launched a wobbling 52-yard pass down the field, finding a wide-open Khalil Shakir. That set up the Bills' first touchdown of the game, a three-yard rush from running back Ty Johnson. Again, the Bills' defense forced a three-and-out, and the offense began to work down the field. After picking up two first downs, offensive coordinator Joe Brady decided it was time for a trick play, lining Allen up out wide and having Curtis Samuel take the snap. Under pressure, Samuel lateraled it to Allen, who took a heavy shot while the ball was tipped out of his hand, resulting in a fumble recovered by Baltimore. That was the beginning of the end, as Baltimore took just six plays to add another touchdown, ballooning their lead up to 28-10. A missed field goal from Tyler Bass, then another impressive drive from Jackson and Derrick Henry, the Ravens took a 35-10 lead, all but solidifying the win. The frustrating loss for Buffalo will leave Bills fans with a sour taste in their mouths until the team's next game day, which will be another heavyweight matchup. Buffalo will head to Houston next Sunday afternoon for a meeting with Stephon Diggs and the Houston Texans. The Clymer Sherman Panama Wolfpack were dialed in on Friday Night Lights, defeating their Class D rival Franklinville Ellicottville 21-6 in Week 5. Led by their third-year quarterback Tate Catanese, the CSP offense displayed poise and professional execution, dissecting the Titans' defensive scheme time and time again. Catanese, a senior at Panama High School, threw for over 240 yards and three touchdowns, connecting with three different wide receivers for the Wolfpack. Alex Barmore, Carter Brink, and Bryce Hinsdale found themselves in the end zone throughout the evening, with Brink leading all pass catchers with over 100 yards. Impressive despite the score was Franklinville High School senior and two-way starter Billy Slavinsky, as he averaged 5 yards per rush and was a difference maker in the Titans' lone scoring drive. CSP moves to 3-1 on the season and turn their attention toward Lackawanna in Week 5. Franklinville Ellicottville, now 2-2 on the year, hosts Randolph in another divisional game next week. The WNBA playoffs are down to just four teams. It's a rematch of last year's championship on one side of the bracket, as the number one seeded New York Liberty faced the two-time defending champion Las Vegas Aces. In Game 1 on Sunday, the hometown Liberty never trailed, winning 88-77 on the shoulders of Brianna Stewart, who had a game-high 34 points. In the other semifinal series, the second-seeded Minnesota Lynx take on the number 3-seed Connecticut Sun. Sunday night, the Sun outlasted the Lynx, holding on in the final seconds for a 73-70 win. Game 2 of both best-of-five series are slated for tomorrow night in Brooklyn and Minneapolis, respectively. The talk of the baseball world for the last few weeks has been the Detroit Tigers, who clinched their first playoff berth in a decade by winning 16 of their last 22 games. That being said, the road to the World Series runs through the Bronx in the American League as the Yankees have clinched the top seed. The MLB postseason bracket is set with the Wild Card Series beginning Tuesday. This has been the scoreboard for Monday, September 30th. I'm Jack Cruiser for WBFO Sports.
Don't forget to like or subscribe so you can help others find this podcast. And if you love it, leave a review too. The WBFO Brief Podcast and the award-winning journalism of WBFO's news team are made possible by our members. Thank you for listening.